Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. I hope you're doing well. This is Cliff, your host, and welcome to Earth Ancients. The shaman programs that I've had the last week are really turning out to be quite interesting for me. I, years ago, as you know, produced conferences with the theme of shamanism, and it's been a subject that anthropologists have studied and continues to be an interest for a lot of people who are being transformed by shamanistic ceremony through various processes and theories and things like that, as well as taking the psychotropic drugs, among them ayahuasca. Since that show last week, people have been sending me various photographs and images from different artists who have taken ayahuasca, and it's just amazing. It's blowing my mind. The book The Cosmic Serpent by Jeremy Narby was brought to my attention, and I had a chance to look at it, and he describes a process where there is another intelligence, another form of consciousness that is available to us, but only through the use of this drug, ayahuasca, which is a plant-based drug that's mixed into a concoction and brewed, apparently, and then consumed. But, you know, it's funny, I was doing some research and looking around and trying to find some well-known artists, and I did come across Alex Gray, who is an American artist whose work is just phenomenal. And if you ever get a chance to see his paintings, the colors alone are mind-blowing, to the point where they're just almost neon and vibrantly rich, and how he mixes the colors are fascinating. What I also discovered was that almost to a person, the artists who are considered ayahuasca artists use similar palettes, and the colors are so radiating, so radiant that they come up, they just kind of pop off the page. And I would love to talk to Alex. In fact, I might get him on the program just to speak to him about his experience and what he went through and the transformation that he went through. But getting an explanation of the process, the transformational process of an ayahuasca experience is different for everybody. But I did find quite a unique description by Graham Hancock. And if you guys don't know who Graham Hancock is, he wrote the book Fingerprints of the Gods, which was an international bestseller. And he's somebody that I find is just an amazing philosopher, artist, slash writer. And he's taken ayahuasca a number of times. And I happened to find this interview he did. It's a few minutes, and I'm going to play it right now. And it actually describes the process of ayahuasca and what unfolds during the process of an ayahuasca experience. So let's take a quick listen to this, and I'll be right back. This is Graham Hancock explaining. This is actually recorded a couple of years ago where he explains the process of ayahuasca.
An ayahuasca journey is a complex and difficult process. First off, there's the physical effects. Ayahuasca is a beverage. It's a brew, and it tastes is absolutely disgusting. It is hard to imagine a more horrific and unpleasant taste. And you have to brace yourself physically and mentally before pouring this beverage down your throat. I certainly do. It's very, very, very hard work. Secondly, within about half an hour to an hour of drinking the brew, most of us start to feel pretty ill. You're vomiting, you have diarrhea. It's a most physically a most uncomfortable ordeal that you have to go through before the powerful visionary effects that begin to take place. And those visionary effects typically have two levels. One of them concerns what you might call personal development. You know, in the Amazon, they believe that there is an intelligent spirit that lies behind ayahuasca. They don't think they're dealing with just plants, and who are we to say they're wrong? The shamans believe that an intelligent entity, a spirit being, lies behind the ayahuasca beverage, and that she, and they always regard her as a female presence, that her business is the planet and the betterment of human beings. Strange idea, huh? But this is what they believe in the Amazon, and they know a damn sight more about it than we do. Well, one of the ways this works is that ayahuasca will typically show you your own life in an extremely clear and unconfused way. You know, normally we protect our own behavior with all sorts of little personal explanations and reasons for why we behave in the way that we do. Ayahuasca will show you absolutely clearly and honestly really why you behaved in the way that you did. Sometimes you may have been mean or harsh to another person and pass that off as absolutely the right thing to do under the circumstances. Ayahuasca will show you it was the wrong thing to do. It will show you that anger and ego and arrogance and pride in your own personality are not serving you and are not helpful. And it will keep teaching you these lessons again and again and again, showing you starkly and honestly how you are until you start fixing your behavior and improve the way that you function in the world and work hard to become a less toxic and more positive person. Ayahuasca has done this for me, and it's done it for countless other people who I know. It's a mystery, but there it is. It puts you through that psychological process where you actually start examining your own life and asking questions about the way you behave. The second thing that ayahuasca does is take you on a journey into parallel realms. Now, of course, many scientists would say this is just brain candy. This is just an illusion of your own brain, disturbed brain chemistry. I don't agree with those scientists. I can't prove they're wrong, but when I look at the burden of evidence, and particularly of the huge body of knowledge that shamanistic cultures have brought together on the use of visionary plants, I'm inclined to believe that they're right, and that reality is much more complicated than we imagine, and that we are surrounded all the time by a vast invisible reality, normally invisible to our senses. And what I've found, and many others report this with ayahuasca, is that it seems to retune the receiver wavelength of the brain and allow those normal invisible realms to become visible for a brief period. So it connects us to a much wider reality. This can be deeply disturbing, but also incredibly nourishing, to realize that we are not just this finite little dot, that we're part of a much huger and wider and awe-inspiring reality. And the third thing that happens with ayahuasca, and it's very curious, is that if you have some aspect of your life that's creative, could be writing poetry, could be painting, ayahuasca again and again will enhance that. All over the world now, we're seeing incredible visionary art produced by people who've been inspired by ayahuasca. Now, this is not news to the shamans in the Amazon, because they create incredible visionary art and have done for thousands of years, documenting their ayahuasca journeys. But it's happening in the West now. I'm thinking of people like Alex Gray, Bob Vinosa, Martina Hoffman, who have brought into being incredible works of art inspired by their ayahuasca experiences. It seems to enhance certain aspects of human creativity. All of these things are available to us should we choose to drink ayahuasca. We do not have to drink ayahuasca. It's a personal choice. I would like to live in a society where that personal choice can be made free of fear, free of ideology, free of propaganda, simply a decision that an adult makes about his or her own life. I'm not.
So that is Graham Hancock's interpretation of his experience with ayahuasca. And some of the points he makes is that it expands the level of creativity. And it's just, I mean, it just blows my mind how amazingly rich and vivid these artists are. And to a person, again, it seems like this experience, this level of consciousness that they achieve, or that is achieved through this ayahuasca experience, creates or opens them to perceptions that are unworldly or beyond our capable senses that we're dealing with right now. So a fascinating aspect of shamanism. And I will be posting some photographs from Alex Gray on the website after this program, just to kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about, the rich and expansive designs and colors that are featured in these works. And more than just a current kind of a pattern and design and concept, this has been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. These types of ayahuasca experiences, these artisans have been around doing this, and it is tapping into a consciousness which is almost an earth consciousness, a consciousness that is around us, that permeates what we're doing, who we are. We just have to be aware of it. We have to be aware of it. And for me, in my meditative practices, I get a sense of it when I walk and I go do my outdoor hiking. There's a sense of it too. You don't need to take a psychotropic drug to experience it, but this is just one aspect of a consciousness that I'm kind of introducing you to. So take a look at that. Again, remember, Earth Ancients is mainly placed on our Facebook page, and you can see all of this information on the fan page by going to Facebook and dialing in Earth Ancients. Remote viewing is the subject for today. I have been aware of it for a few years. About 20 years ago, I had heard about it and had an individual who had experienced it. There's a number of I should say that one time there was a number of individuals who were teaching remote viewing. Some had come out of the military. Some had been trained by individuals who had worked for organizations that were doing remote viewing. But my guest today is Dr. Courtney Brown, and he has developed what I think is a fascinating program and has done some just some amazing research on the past, the present, and probably the future. Courtney Brown is a mathematician and a social scientist who teaches in the Department of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. He is an independent at the university. He's a leading scholar on the subject of remote viewing, as it is done using procedures that were developed by the United States military, which was used for espionage purposes, or procedures that were derivative of those techniques. His organization is called Farsight, and he is director and founder of Farsight Institute, a nonprofit research and educational organization dedicated to the study of a phenomenon of non-local consciousness known as remote viewing. He has a book called The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, and apparently it's the only book of its kind where the science of remote viewing is developed with respect to highly structured data collection methodologies of the kind utilized by the United States military. So this is going to be very interesting. Welcome to the program, Courtney. How are you today?
Cliff, I'm fine, and I want to thank you so much for inviting me on.
Well, glad you could join us. Tell us a little bit about your interest and why an academic like yourself would pick it up and want to take it to the level that you have. What was your interest in remote viewing?
Well, it's important to understand that I do not do any remote viewing research at my university. I do everything independent of the university. At the university, I only teach statistics, nonlinear differential equations, and things like that in a social science program. All the work I do in remote viewing is done at the Farsight Institute. And best way to know that is www.farsight, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far, .org, O-R-G, because we're a nonprofit. And the work that I do at the Farsight Institute really started in the 1990s when the official military program in remote viewing was declassified and released and then closed down in November of 1995. But everyone that I respect understands that the program started up again right away and is even much bigger now than it was back in those days. And that if that ever becomes public, they'll close that one down and say, gosh, I don't know. How did that happen? It must have been a rogue general. and then they'll start it up. They'll start it up again. So remote viewing is a very important phenomenon for U.S. military intelligence, although it's not spoken about publicly. The idea that we do things in the military that I'm not in the military, but the idea that the military does things and doesn't speak about them publicly should be commonsensical to everyone. The U.S. military budget is the U.S. military budget is larger than all military budgets of every country on the planet Earth combined. I mean, if you took everybody else's military budget and added them all together, the U.S. military budget is bigger than all of that. And the largest chunk of all of our military spending is in black. Meaning, there's no line item anything for it. No one knows what it's spent for. So we very commonly have lots of programs that are off the books and not under civilian supervision. So oversight, congressional oversight, things like that. So that's normal. So one should not be surprised that such stuff is going on. Now, there was another movement, not a program, but another movement within the military going on at the same time that the official program was housed in the Defense Intelligence Agency. And that movement came out of Special Forces and later became known as the 1st Earth Battalion. And that was featured in the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats, starring Jeff Bridges and George Clooney. So there were two, both of them were, both the movement and the official program were housed in the U.S. Army in the intelligence area. But nonetheless, it was a separate type of thing. And the people that I work with, I normally do not do the remote viewing for the projects that we do at the Foresight Institute. I'm normally the chief investigator, and the remote viewers that I work with are literally the very best remote viewers on the planet Earth. People like Dick Elgar, who uses the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild methods, and that's, or the HRVG methods, that was taught to him by Glenn Wheaton, and Glenn came out of Special Forces Intelligence, the 1st Battalion thing. And then I work also with people like Daz Smith, who does controlled remote viewing, or CRV. And that is a method that came out of the official program in the Defense Intelligence Agency. But these people are the very best, and they can do things that a lot of people call scary good on a very regular basis, meaning we do projects, and their participation in the projects is unbelievably accurate and detailed with regard to perceiving across time and space under absolutely, totally blind conditions, meaning the only thing they're given is an email from me saying there is a target, remote view it. That's it.
Okay.
They're not told, like, I want you to remote view the Eiffel Tower. That's impossible to do, because remote viewing has to be done independent of the conscious mind, because your imagination and memory would kick in, what you saw on postcards would kick in, and that would produce junk as data. So it's got to be pure nonlinear, non-local perception.
Okay.
So you can't know anything about it.
Why don't you tell the audience, describe what remote viewing is and how it actually works?
Well, remote viewing is a form of perception, and it is done in the normal waking state of consciousness. So what was the drug you were talking about before I got on?
Ayahuasca? Ayahuasca, yeah.
So that is both similar and different in the sense that with ayahuasca or a psychotropic drug, one has legitimate experiences, but they're uncontrolled, meaning you're not in control. The drug has induced that state. And remote viewing is a similar type of thing, but it's done in the total waking state of consciousness without any drug use at all. And so it's very hard to do. That's why so many people like Graham Hancock like to use things like ayahuasca, because it's relatively easy to do. You just take it and you have those experiences. But with remote viewing, you have to actually train the mind to perceive across time and space, to be able to see these parallel realities, alternate locations, everything that you can possibly imagine. It's a natural experience, but our physiology is such that it inhibits that. Our brains are essentially extremely complex hologram generators. And what they do is they perceive frequencies. Now, in the universe that exists today, no physicist has ever, in all of time, has ever found anything solid. You say, well, I look at my computer, my radio, my car, my body, it's solid. And I say, no, that's just empty space and molecules. And inside the molecules is empty space and atoms. And inside the atoms is empty space and protons and neutrons and electrons. And inside those and down the rabbit hole it goes. No physicist has ever, ever found anything solid anywhere in the universe. The only thing they ever find is frequencies, energy, that forms in combination things that they like to call wave packets. And those wave packets, they emerge in a perceptual state that we see as solid things. And so basically what we're doing is our brains only have access to frequencies. There is no solid thing. So the frequencies that it actually perceives, it has to combine in a way that's very similar to how a television set works or a radio, where it screens out all other frequencies except the ones that it wants you to focus on and assembles a picture. And that picture is incredibly realistic. It's so convincing that people assume it's actually real and there is only one reality. So what that ayahuasca does is it inhibits the brain to be able to do its job as a limiter of perception. What remote viewing does is train the conscious mind to be able to have those alternate perceptions that are normally screened out perceived anyway in the absence of drugs. In fact, with remote viewing, we strongly recommend absolutely no psychotropic involvement at all. And I don't even drink tea and coffee because you need to keep the nervous system as pristine as possible. Now, other remote viewers don't necessarily go along with this. They drink wine and beer and things like that. But in its purest state, you are basically doing the same type of thing as what you're talking about with the ayahuasca thing, except you're approaching it from a different perspective. So you're approaching it from perspective of training the brain to allow in those perceptions that you're otherwise screening out. But again, that's why ayahuasca works. You are essentially putting the brain in a straitjacket so it can't do the job it was supposed to do. So then those perceptions come across. With remote viewing, it's different. You're actually in a completely undrug-induced state. You're in a normal waking state of consciousness, literally working with the brain to train it to allow in perceptions that it otherwise would not allow in, and then to focus on those things. So in a physical sense, how does it work? You physically go into a room. Excuse me. You go into a room in the traditional military days, you'd go into a room with paper, with a stack of paper and a pen on a desk. The only thing you'd be told is there a target. And an hour later, you'd come out with 20 pages of detailed data describing that target. Now, the quality, in my opinion, of the remote viewing that we do now is far better than the best that was achieved back in the old remote viewing days. And the quality of the remote viewing that will be done in 20 years from now by other people, not us, will be far better than what we do today at the Forest Aid Institute.
How can you say that, Courtney? How do you say that? Is it the techniques that you're developing?
No, it's not necessarily techniques. It's the refinement of the practice itself. So it's a combination of the techniques, how to use the procedures. People get better at things over time. If you look at music, for example, and you go back, I'm a drummer, for example. So if you look back at drummers like Gene Krupa, he was really good back in the old days of Roaring Twenties and so on like that, World War II stuff. Gene Krupa was great. He did a lot of movies. I really like Gene Krupa. And then Buddy Rich came along. And Buddy Rich just did things that nobody ever thought was possible. Buddy Rich could not have existed had Gene Krupa not existed first. So it's just a natural evolution of things. For example, if you look at the piano, how can you have a Lang Lang who performs, you know, stuff that seems physically impossible to move your fingers that fast without previously having a Mozart? So, how can you have a Lang Lang without previously doing other things? And so there's always continual improvement in things. Like, look at the Olympics. Every Olympics, they're breaking records. Well, how can it possibly be that they're still breaking records? What will be the limit to this? We don't know. There's no such thing as a limit. People will just keep on getting better at things. And so we're better now than the way the military people were traditionally, a lot better. And the people that succeed us in other organizations later on, other places, they'll be a lot better than us. And then 100 years from now, there'll be people that are way better than them. And we're moving in the direction of the use of technology also, where eventually you'll be able to put like a skull cap on your head. And the visual images that people are getting, as well as the hearing, touch, of course, the sight, taste, and smell, that'll all be sort of shown on the computer screen in a way that you might say is very similar to the way it was done with Minority Report, that movie with Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Well, let me ask you, you must have had some unique criteria to select the individuals for the Farsight Institute. Did you do, obviously you have to get not only just references, but you must have tested this core group of individuals that you've been working with.
Not really. What we've done is we've worked with people who are trained in the military or military-derived methodologies in public projects. And then certain people just turn out to be really good, much better than others. And then with our more recent projects, we decided to stop working with large numbers of viewers, but rather to work with the very best in specialized projects. And the difference is night and day when you see the quality of the data, because almost anybody after a bit of training can produce evidence that they were connected to the target in some way. They'll have some lines, some sketches, some perceptions that are clearly target related. That's the thing that they were supposed to perceive under blind conditions. But when you get to the point where someone describes in stunning detail, as if, in fact, better than if they were there with their own and saw everything with their own eyes. I say better than because they're not only seeing things really clearly and describing them, but they're also being able to move around in time and space. They can go through walls, see the buildings, what's in the buildings, and so on. There's telepathic communication. So they have access to things that are way beyond sort of the average person. And it is a lot like playing the piano in terms of Lang Lang, for example. Anybody can go, I have a keyboard here in my studio and I can play the piano. Well, I can make noise. I can make noise on the piano. I push the keys and noise comes out. But if I wanted to be on the level of Lang Lang, if it was even possible, we're talking 10, 20 years of constant daily practice, 10, 12 hours a day, to be able to play in Carnegie Hall. I mean, the point is that some people are just extremely dedicated to their art, to their craft. And those are the people we end up working with, not because we tested them, but because we have simply worked with them for so long. It's just obvious, you know, who the better the best are. And so what we really want to do is to show those people as shining examples of what can be done so that they can be an inspiration for other people. If people want to learn how to play the piano, you don't let them listen to me playing chopsticks. You let them listen to Lang Lang. And then they say, oh, so that's what it's all about. Now I understand. And so, you know, that's how you do it. And, you know, always there's going to be people that are pushing the edges. And you just have to be able to keep your eyes out for people who are pushing the edges. For example, when Franz Liszt came about, the great composer of the last century, when he came out, he wanted to do things that was, He was a virtuoso pianist. He played the piano, and Franz Liszt was inhibited by playing music that came out of the, and of course you're talking the 1800s now, but he was inhibited by playing music that came out of the classical period and the classical school, which was the Mozart, Beethoven, Bach era, that whole thing that came out of Vienna. And he could play better. He could put his fingers on the piano and do more things. So he simply stopped doing concerts with that stuff, and he started to write his own stuff. And that's where we get things like the Hungarian Rhapsodies, because he wanted to be able to play music that could challenge him and show people what he could do. So he was the one who invented the idea of there's no such thing as too many notes. That's one of the reasons Lang Lang is such a great pianist. He can play at the level of Franz Liszt, meaning you can't even see his fingers move across the piano. It's just going so fast. And so that's what basically what happens with remote viewing. We wait and work until people get really good. Now, and under no circumstance should anyone think that I'm saying anything disparaging about previous remote viewers, even though the current day remote viewers are better. That's like saying, well, Mozart was a jerk because Lang Lang is a better pianist. I mean, that's stupid. Yeah. Mozart was Mozart. He was one of the greatest right. composers and pianists of all time. So,
right.
you know, that doesn't diminish the fact that Lang Lang can play unbelievably doesn't diminish anybody in the past. But it's just a mm-hmm. natural course of history that people get okay. better with things over time.
Let's talk about your institute. Now, you have this wonderful website, farsight.org, filled with a number of projects that you have listed here. Before we get into some of these projects, and I, there's no way to list them all. I'm just going to pick a few in the time that we have today. Why don't you tell us what you're hoping people derive from these remote viewings? Are you presenting them with another perspective of reality? Are you presenting them with just another way to look at a subject matter? What is the core definition of your work, and what are you hoping people derive and get out of this?
Actually, Cliff, that's a brilliant question, and you hit the million-dollar button. The idea is not to show just the results of these projects, from our science projects to our exploration projects. The idea, the bottom line, the real reason why we do what we do, is to demonstrate to people that we are more than our physical bodies, that we live in a greater reality, and that when we exist here as physical human beings, it's a vague shadow of a larger existence that we came from before we were born, and that we go back to after we were born. Obviously, we're not using the physical body when we remote view it, because you're going through time and space to perceive things that you have no physical access to. So obviously, when the physical body drops off, you're still there. Otherwise, whatever was there, you wouldn't have been able to do the remote viewing in the first place. So our particular genetics is structured such that all of that other stuff gets screened out. The telepathy gets screened out. The remote perception normally gets screened out. You don't see the gazelle that was there yesterday when you're out in the outback, or nor do you see the elephant that was there tomorrow. You only see the lion that's in front of you today. And that's what the brain is supposed to do. That's its job. But once you see the larger reality, then you have a completely different perspective on who you are. Now, that's one of the real reasons why it's been so difficult for humanity to come to grips with the extraterrestrial presence, the UFOs, the aliens. The reason is it disrupts the fantasy, that the mental fantasy, the idea fantasy that we have developed over the ages, that we are the center of the universe, that God created us in his image, and that we were given the entire universe just for ourselves to play with, and the entire other everything, the galaxies and everything, we just are dots in the sky for us to just look at, because we're everything and all there is. So for us to get out of that, to mature as a species with a destiny, the key, the bridge, is remote viewing, because that's what tells us that we are different from just what we think we are, that there is that larger reality. Now, extraterrestrials, of course, are completely fluent with all of this. And that's why it's so difficult for them to interact with us one-on-one, because when we interact with them, it's a shock to our system. It just doesn't compatible with our thinking. So the role of Farsight is to bridge that gap. In part, we do science projects that explore the nature of time and physical reality, and that's such as our Multiple Universes project, the data for which and the experiment was published in a leading peer-reviewed journal, and that's also available on our website. But we also do exploration, such as the most recent project, Aliens on Iapetus, which is an alien facility that was built in the distant past. We have a nice, cooler picture of it, supplied by NASA at the Cassini space probe, and we found out what it was used for, and who was there, and how they died. Very interesting story.
Okay.
Remote viewing. And so we do projects like that to sort of interest people in this stuff. And as they become more interested in it, they learn more about themselves. And that's sort of the key.
So the takeaway you're saying is that as they are viewing your data in the form of videos or an audio presentation, you're hoping that they will see that this is something that they are also have in their physicality and their dimensionality as a human being, and that this is something that they just need to be more aware of. Is that what you're saying? They should be aware of their multidimensionality?
Cliff, yes. You said it exactly right. Now, I want to say that when you said how we present the information, in the old days, the military still does, but in the old days, we also used to do it the way the military did, which is do it on paper and pen. Mm-hmm. Now, that is more dreadfully boring to watch than the grass growing. The grass growing is like watching a science fiction Star Wars movie compared to that. I mean, it's just boring to watch people draw on a piece of paper. So what we did, and then you have to convince people that the things that are being drawn look like the target. I mean, the thing that they were supposed to perceive. I mean, it's just not, no matter how good they are, you got to force people to sit down and force them to look at pieces of paper that are dreadfully boring to watch. It just doesn't work. So what we decided to do, this was pioneered originally by Dick Allgaier, who was a celebrity newscaster. He was the face of the news on Hawaii for 30 years. And he was more used to being in front of a camera than off camera. So he said, well, why don't we do this standing up on whiteboard? And I said, I don't think that's a good idea. Let's do it the normal way. And he said, no, I'm going to try it anyway. I said, okay, give it a try. So he tried it, and it turned out to be great. And so we put that session done under totally blind conditions in our Atlantis project. And that's interesting to you because you're Earth Ancients. So, and that's available for free on our website. It's put up on YouTube. And so that was an anomaly on the bottom of the ocean, 3 miles deep, 1,000 miles west of Portugal and Morocco, plus some a similar anomaly, a set of anomalies down near Antarctica on the bottom of the ocean. And the
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So we have I want to start with Atlantis, because what you chose as targets are quite unique areas. You chose a location off of Spain in the Atlantic Ocean on the bottom floor, and then you chose another target. I think it was off of Iceland.
Off of Antarctica. Off of Antarctica.
Oh, Antarctica. Excuse me, Antarctica on the floor of the of the ocean, and they both have very unique patterns. These images that are seen in Google Earth. So why don't you tell us what you discovered without giving away everything? But I mean, it's quite unique because the video describes a very advanced civilization. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I don't mind giving away this. We want people to see it. I mean, it's available for free. If they
it's
go to our website,
yeah.
If we go to our website at farsight.org, either on the navigation bar on the left, or just scroll down, you'll see a big banner saying Atlantis. Just click on it and watch it. And what it basically is, it was our first project where we did live remote viewing. And that is where the viewer is under totally blind condition, is standing up in front of a whiteboard and describing it. Now, that turned out to be not boring. That turned out to be incredibly hair-raising, because you're actually watching it happening. He's not recounting what he perceived and said, this is what I saw. You're actually watching it live. And so all of our projects from then on, Atlantis was the first one that did it. And then we did the Great Pyramid of Giza, the 9/11 events, Cydonia Mars, aliens on Iapetus. Now the only thing we do is video projects, where everything is recorded live on video. So that was a game changer. That was the game changer, because you can't watch our recent projects without literally wondering if you're going to fall off your seat. I mean, they're so riveting. It takes the paper and pen stuff and moves it aside. Now, what the Atlantis thing was, is before we started this Atlantis project on Google Earth, I saw this anomaly on the bottom of the ocean, in Atlantic Ocean and then also down near Antarctica. And so I was saying, well, am I going to be able to, I wonder if, you know, because there were some mainstream scientists who were saying that those things are the results of ship tracks. Now, ship tracks are, those images are actually gotten from sonar data that's paid for by the U.S. government. And the sonar data produces what they call ship tracks, unless the ships travel in overlapping strips back and forth, covering a large swath of area. Because what happens is the sonar right below the ship is really clear. And then on either side of that, it's fuzzy. So it looks like two railroad tracks with everything clear in the middle and everything fuzzy on the side. If the ship just goes off in the, you know, in a direction. But if it's overlapping back and forth stuff, then the clear comes in perfectly. You know, the overlapping back and forth makes everything clear. So they were saying that those were ship tracks. And I looked at them and I said, those aren't ship tracks. Ship tracks have two parallel, perfectly parallel lines on either side with clear imagery in the middle and fuzzy stuff on the outside. And those look like things that were buried with silt. It looks like there was ruins on the bottom of the ocean that were, they didn't look at all like ship tracks. I know what ship tracks look like as far as I was concerned. So now this part, I'm going to say, you is hearsay because it's true, but I can't prove it. In a court of law, they'd call it hearsay because I can't bring the people in who said it originally. But I had access to, we work with military people. So I had access to someone in who had a security clearance, a high-level security clearance, military security clearance, who was able to go and talk to the actual technicians that had the original data. Do you understand, Cliff?
Yeah.
So I asked as a favor if that person would go in and talk to the actual technicians. I'm not talking about professors or PhDs. I'm talking about the guys behind the computer console who had the actual data. And I said, would you mind just going in there, talking to them, tell them about the ship track story, and just tell them what the blankety blank is that? And the person came back, and what I was told is that when the person relayed the ship track idea, they laughed, and they brought up the original data and said, those aren't ship tracks. Those are real elevation data. If you had ship tracks that were wavy and looked like that, the companies that were hired by the U.S. government to produce those images would have been fired. I mean, the ship tracks don't look like that. And so they said, those are real elevation data. They laughed at the ship track idea. And so I said, okay, now that's hearsay as far as you're concerned, because I can't bring those people up to a judge. If I told that to a judge, the judge would say, well, that's just hearsay. You have to, who is the person that you sent that did this? Bring that and put that person on the witness stand and let me cross-examine that person. That's what would happen. So since we can't do that, it's called hearsay, and it would be thrown out in a court of law. So I just give it to you for what it is, meaning it's part of the history of why I pursued the Atlantis story, because I got that feedback. So I said, okay, I've got feedback that I personally trust. I trust my eyes. I know that those are not ship tracks from what I know of ship tracks. And so I'm said that that's good enough for me to do a remote viewing project on that. And we had the two remote viewers, Deborah Duggan Takagi and Dick Allgaier, both of who were using the HRVG or Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild procedures, do that project under totally blind conditions. And Dick did a session that was on video, which was the thing. When he did that, I was so grateful he did that because I was able to see. You know, people can tell you they have a good idea, but you never really believe it or understand it until you see it. And so once I saw it, I said, oh, wow, that changes everything.
It is very cool.
So anyway, what it turned out that while we were finishing up the remote viewing, it took months to finish the remote viewing for this under totally blind conditions. They were never told anything. They got everything. They got it was underwater, that it was ruins, an ancient city, an ancient civilization, and what happened to it. The actual society was about 100 years more advanced technologically than we are today. So they're pretty close to where we are today, but a little more advanced. And they destroyed themselves. And I'll tell you what happened a little later.
Can you just, before we go into it too far, can you give us an approximate date? Can they give a
70,000 years ago
is when it went down.
It happened 70,000 years ago. And the reason it went, and the reason we know that is that the place that they used where they destroyed themselves was down near New Zealand. And you have to understand that the Earth is really not a very good planet to live on. It's really a planet of last resort. There must be a reason why we're here, because things must have been really bad elsewhere for us to get here. So Earth is really a bad planet, because what it is, it's an 8,000-mile ball of liquid molten rock, and it has an 8-mile thin crust on it. That means we're living on a balloon, on the surface of a balloon. And for 10,000 years, it's fine. There's no problem. But if you go like 20,000 years out, eventually the sun will burp, a coronal mass ejection will come in our direction, the liquid below us will quiver, and then the crust will crack. And what happens is there's a lot of evidence, archaeological evidence, that human society has actually raised itself a number of times and then been totally, you know, knocked down to smithereens.
Yeah.
But this and that, for example, was been documented by a Boston University professor, for example, Robert Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H, who wrote a very interesting book called Forgotten Civilizations. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, we have risen before and that something happened. Well, the fact is we live on a balloon and there is a natural processes, especially when the sun burps in our direction, where the crust of the balloon gets all messed up and, you know, there's only a few survivors and we build back again. But what happened during the Atlantis time period, and we know that was 70,000 years ago, is that they were actually trying to drill through the crust. Now, this is not like a volcano, so that there's like a little crack and a little lava and a little steam happens and boom, there's a pop. This was like the channel or Lincoln Tunnel and Holland Tunnel and everything all combined. They were drilling huge boreholes straight through the crust down in the New Zealand area in an attempt to get at the heat below. And they thought they could control it. And what happened was, and it's all documented in the documentary, which is free and you can watch it today. What happened is that they popped the balloon. Now, that area down in down near New Zealand, that has the thinnest crust on the planet and the largest concentration of lava rock on the planet. And the mainstream science, what they do is they call that the Toba catastrophe theory for Lake Toba. They assume it was something like the volcano at Lake Toba in Indonesia. They got the general area correct, but they not exactly correct, but it's in that same area of the globe. But the exact spot was down near New Zealand, which isn't too far away from Indonesia. And what happened was it was not the volcano at Toba. It was boreholes that were drilled right through the earth. They popped it. There was an explosion that was way bigger than any number of hydrogen bombs that you can imagine blowing up. It was huge. You could have seen it from Mars. I mean, it was huge, a huge blowout. And what happened is when you blow out one spot of a balloon, you get a dent in exactly the opposite side. And now that opposite side of the balloon is called the antipode. Antipode, P-O-D-E, antipode. So the antipode is the opposite side of where the blowout occurred. And that antipode is exactly, not approximately, not in the general area, but exactly where the anomaly on the bottom of the ocean is, 3 miles deep, 1,000 miles west of Portugal and Morocco, which means that 70,000 years ago, and we know the dating because it's not dispute, that event happened 70,000 years ago. That is not dispute in mainstream science, that explosion. And what happens is there was a dent then, and the dent was that area of Europe that extended 1,000 miles west of Portugal sunk, and it ended up 3 miles deep. So that's how we know it was 70,000 miles, because of the the nature of the explosion and the fact that the anomaly is the antipode of where the explosion happened, and they have a solid understanding of when that explosion occurred. They call it Tobit catastrophe theory, but you know, it wasn't. It was
so. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, and then we're going to move on to the next subject. And by the way, people that are listening, you can see this great video on farsight.org. It's actually the Atlantis, the true story is the title of the video. Tell us, Courtney, a little bit about what your remote viewers picked up in terms of the consciousness of these people. Were they similar to us? Were they highly evolved? Were they less evolved consciously? Obviously, if they're about 100 years in advance technologically to us, they had a active science in place. But what about consciousness? Yeah.
They were pretty much like us. They had more advances in genetic engineering. They were about 100 years more advanced than us. I mean, they had flat panel TV. They had flat panel computer screens that were big, very similar to the way we look. Their technology rooms were very, you'd be very comfortable with them. And so if you walked into one of their military industrial type of facilities, you would immediately recognize it as a military industrial facility. Their architecture was very similar to New York architecture, especially New York or Chicago architecture, especially around the 1950s, 60s. The cities seemed to have, it was like Grand Central Station or Penn Station, that type of architecture with arches and stone buildings and things like that. And the facility down near Antarctica was a different architecture. There, it was very similar to squared off skyscrapers, sort of the glass box type skyscrapers that we often see. So it was a different, it was a look and feel that was more, sort of modern architecture that came about in the 1970s, 80s, the glass box type architecture. And a lot of that Antarctica type of stuff was underground also. So they had buildings that were above ground and buildings that were below ground. And a lot of that, by the way, that does tell you exactly why the government has so many Antarctica digs going on, despite the very harsh climatic conditions. They're not spending all that money and sending all those people down there to look for mastodon bones. They're looking for tech. There's stuff, lots of it, buried underneath the ice. And really? It's very hard to get it because, it's very harsh conditions, but they're digging up tech, tech that we can understand. You know, when you're dealing with extraterrestrial tech, that type of technology sometimes is hard for us to reverse engineer. A lot of it takes a long time and so on. But Atlantis tech is very similar to ours, more advanced than ours, but very similar. And the learning curve between them and us is pretty clear. So,
yeah. But you also say that in your tape, and this is what Casey talks about, Edgar Casey, is that a lot of their technology is based on piezoelectric energy, which is crystal energy, or piezoelectric,
The remote viewers clearly perceived energy reactors that were based on crystalline, and they were very clean, extremely clean. They were so clean and so good, those reactors, it makes me wonder why the blankety blank were they drilling through the crust to try to get to the core in the first place.
Yeah.
But, human folly has no limits sometimes. Mm-hmm. But they were very like us. And they also had a lot of spiritual stuff that was going on. They really did sort of dive into the spiritual element as well. But the project that was the bore through the core, bore through the crust project, that was a secret project. And when it started to go belly up, they saw the beginnings of it happen, and they actually had 2 or 3 days before it actually finished, maybe a day or so, but there was some time. It wasn't like an immediate boom. And because what we actually watched with the remote viewers, we watched the technicians glued to their screen, seeing it unravel. There were announcements made all over the planet, loudspeaker type announcement. People were assembling outside, where people were told what was going to happen. They were given like advance warning, not like a week or 2 weeks, but like a day or so. And then an attempt was made to try to save as many people as possible. They knew that it was a extinction level event, potentially. And an attempt was made to save. So they were getting people onto boats. The only men that were allowed on the boats were the ones that had the able to that were needed in order to sail the boats. Otherwise, it was women who were of childbearing age, fecund women, women who were capable of having children or had children. Those were the ones who were being led onto the boats. Now, what I'm going to say now is not really in dispute. It's called, you can find it in Wikipedia under Toba catastrophe theory, but this part is not in dispute. 70,000 years ago, when this thing happened, everybody on the entire planet was killed off except for around, this is an average, approximately 3,000 pairs of surviving humans. Now, what we mean by a pair, it could be anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000, but around 3,000 pairs of people. Now, a pair is two people. And there might have been more people that survived, but they weren't having babies. So those pairs that survived, like the 6,000 people or 3,000 pairs, they were having babies. So absolutely everybody on the planet today, whether you're Aborigine, African, Caucasian, European, Hispanic, Asian, no matter who you are, where you came from, we are all related to the same 3,000 pairs of surviving people from the event of 70,000 years ago.
Wow.
And again, a lot of this is not, what I just told you now is not in dispute. It's actually was discovered by the geneticists, the people who study the genetics of people, and they've traced it back to 3,000 pairs of people who were having babies 70,000 years ago. It's part of the juggernaut element or theory of the Toba catastrophe theory, because something happened 70,000 years ago, that volcanic event, and that killed off everybody, and very few people survived. So we have 7 billion people now that are all resulting from, say, 6,000.
Fascinating. Would you say our government has an idea about an Atlantis or a sophisticated...
The government knows all of this stuff. The government knows all of this stuff. I mean, in fact, in the middle of near the end of the remote viewing phase of this, the Google Earth came out with Google Earth 2.0, which essentially erased almost all of the anomaly on the Atlantic Ocean. And
why would they care to do that? I mean,
you have to understand that all underwater Google Earth imagery is government, because it all was taken by government-funded sonar data, so they can do whatever they want with it before it. Now, some scientists were announcing happily, you see, that anomaly went away. When we fixed it, we just had to do it a little better. But I looked at that, and I looked at it carefully, and I said, that's a lot of bull. What they did was they applied, I have to say in my opinion, but I'm very clear on this. What they did was they applied high compression algorithms to smooth out the data. And you can smooth out the Rocky Mountains in a picture if you put enough high compression algorithm on it. And in the video, I go through the evidence of the high compression algorithms that were used, because you get large patches of area down where that anomaly is that have absolutely no gradation of color, of shades of gray, for example. And it's all, the flatness of the image exactly follows pixel lines. So that's exactly what happens when you take any image and you compress it enough. What you're doing is you're getting rid of the color variation. Now, in a raw image where you don't have much compression, every pixel has its own color value or its own temperature value or its own, grayscale value or whatever. So you get a tremendous amount of detail. But those files are really large, and so compression is a fact of life, that we have to have some element of compression, especially when you're dealing with Google Earth stuff. But if you do too much, especially in certain areas, you flatten it. And so I look at that and I just said, that's ridiculous. Nothing was fixed at all. They just compressed the thing away. And so I looked at the early and then I looked at the late, and I said, this is yet more evidence that, now I am not saying, I am not N-O-T. I am not saying that any scientist or oceanographer or whatever corrupted the Google Earth data in order to pull the wool over humanity. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that these data are government data originally, and the government can do anything they want with the data. And for me personally, they can do anything they want with the data before even anybody else gets a hold of it. And for me personally, the story about ship tracks, which was completely abandoned after Google Earth 2.0 came about, as if it never had happened, because the ship track story was so stupid. It's like calling a UFO swamp gas. And so as soon as Google Earth 2.0 came about and they said, see, we got rid of the anomaly, you didn't hear anything more about ship tracks. And now you heard about them fixing things. Well, if I didn't believe the ship tracks thing and that story was abandoned, why should I believe their second story? And, you know, what'll happen when the next story comes out? So the I'm just saying version. For me personally, I didn't believe any of that stuff. Now, to give you an idea of how serious this element is, this problem is, we did another project on an alien base on Mars, and that's available for free on our website as well in our projects. And if you go to that on the nav bar, base on Mars, it was based on a very clear set of pictures, very clear, of a spray coming out of a nozzle that was connected to a pipeline that was leading to a dome. And the spray has a shadow under it and everything. I mean, it's as clear as day. It's totally unambiguous. And so we wanted to know what that thing was. Well, we did a remote viewing project on it. We have very clear imagery of it supplied by NASA and its partners. And so we found out what it was. And in fact, it is a currently occupied base on Mars that is being occupied by people, there are humans like us, that are not the original builders, meaning the people who built the thing have left long ago, and who's ever there now is trying to, they're running into spare parts problems, but they're trying to work with it. Okay, so we did that. Now, Google Earth has a Mars version. So if you go to Google Earth and then click on View, Explore, Mars, you can do that. And if you put in the exact location, which is a special code coming out of the NASA JPL pictures, it's like M11-00099 or something like that, and it's on our page that we have. If you go in, if you put that location in on the Google Earth Mars thing and just hit the enter button, it will fly you to that location, and that spot with the anomalous image has been censored, it's been smeared out. And it's very clear. It's not ambiguous. And I have a picture of the Google Earth imagery on our webpage so you can see the censoring.
Yeah.
So you see, it's not, and you can't say that it was a technological glitch because they didn't have the picture. Because
well,
we showed the original picture. We have the original picture. We show it on our website. There it is.
Yeah.
And so you can't say that the glitch is a technical glitch. We have the original. But the original, you have to get it buried inside a NASA website. Google Earth is something that 7 billion people can easily get to. So that's where the censoring happens. So, you know, the idea of censoring I love Google and I love Google Earth. I mean, I think it's wonderful. But, you know, they live in a world with a government just like us. And if somebody comes along and the government comes along and says, you know, you have to do something because something for XYZ purposes, you know, they are in no position to say no.
You're one of a number of researchers, including myself, who have seen early versions of satellite imagery that was placed on Google Earth. And then as those areas heated up, there were more people making claims about anomalous images and ground archaeology. Then they all of a sudden are gone in an updated version. So this has been going on for years. And I think it's a waste of time that they do that.
But you have to understand, there is so much data out there. It's very hard to police all of it. So there's a lot of stuff to squeak through. And with 7 billion people on the planet, people find it. Now, but understand, I am a great lover of Google and Google Earth and everything. So, you know, I'm not criticizing them. if you know the government is allowing the Farsight Institute to do these projects, there's no question about it. They could close us down in a second. They could close down Google or any company in a second if they wanted to. So the only reason we're able to, so you know, companies don't have complete impunity to do whatever they want. So the only reason we are able to do what we want is to do what we're doing is because somebody in the government has made a decision that it's time for this information, this type of information to come out.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so they're allowing us. I mean, we've had the military guys on our board of directors, for heaven's sake. I mean, we're not a secret organization that the government has to try to monitor. I mean, we're an open book. So, you know, the very fact that we, and the proof of this was our big project on the 9/11 events. When we did the 9/11 events, that was the big test, because as soon as I revealed what the project was to the viewers, the first thing they said, are we going to be allowed to publish this thing? And that was the test, and we were allowed. There was no interference whatsoever. So, you know, there is a lot of people, there are people in the intelligence. Remember, the intelligence people are, they're American citizens. They're human beings on the planet. They have spouses and kids just like everybody else. And they care about the future of the planet. They may have, some of them may have different visions for how the future of the planet should be cared for. But they are concerned about the future just as much as we are. And a good portion of them, you know, must think that what we're doing is important. Otherwise, we would have been stopped.
Right. Let's go on to let's talk about Cydonia in the time we have left. I want to talk about Cydonia and then this moon on Saturn that you guys have done work with. The remote viewing that you did of the Cydonia region. We've had a couple of scientists on here. We had Dr. John Brandenburg, who wrote a book about the actual civilization on Mars based on his discovery of two nuclear detonations in the Cydonia region. What did you guys find?
Cliff, let me interrupt. When did you have John Brandenburg on?
He was on a couple of, he was about a month ago.
Oh, okay. That's great. Because his recent book, Death on Mars, is to die for. I mean, it's a great book.
Yeah, that's the book we were promoting.
He's a nuclear physicist who worked in the Scandia labs.
Yes.
And he's also, you might call a nuclear forensic physicist in the sense that
what he uncovered was amazing. It was totally amazing.
Yeah. It's for people who are willing to have an open mind and look at the data, it's absolutely unambiguous that there was a fission nuclear explosion on Mars. And when it happened, that was the end of the atmosphere on Mars. That was when life on Mars became uninhabitable. But long before that, there was a vibrant civilization on Mars, and there was also another planet nearby that we can call Maldek, for lack of a better word. And that planet exploded. And I'm assuming, although I don't have any direct data on this, I'm assuming it exploded as an act of war, and I'm also assuming that there's a good possibility that Mars is a moon of that planet. Now, we know that because Mars is heavily cratered on one side of it. One side of it is very heavily cratered, and the other side has no craters. The cratered side also is about a kilometer up to 3 kilometers thicker than the uncratered side, which means whatever exploded hit Mars like a shotgun blast and cratered and heavily covered one side of Mars. And that means it must have been very close to Mars. So having Mars as a moon of that other planet makes sort of sense. Now that other planet, we did a whole project called the Exploding Planet Project. And that was basically the origin of the asteroid belt. So our whole history of the solar system really needs heavy revision. But the exploding planet idea has tremendous amount of support from planetary data. And that was data that was accumulated by a guy called Thomas Van Flandern, a very mainstream astronomer. Now, Thomas Van Flandern was head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics for many years at the Naval Observatory. And he amassed an enormous amount of data that clearly indicated that there was a planet, and for whatever reason, it exploded, and that the mainstream approach or the mainstream theory of how the asteroid belt came about was that it was junk or refuse left over from the original primordial solar nebula. Yeah. That theory is just simply stupid. Now, the reason you can say it's really stupid, there's not a shred of evidence to support it. All the evidence supports the idea that there was a planet that exploded. Now Thomas Van Flandern's books that's where you go to get the list of evidence all nicely organized. But let me just give you a couple biggies. The asteroids are big rocks, like Ceres asteroids. They're huge, and they're rocks. Rocks don't form from the primordial solar nebula. That's dust. Dust doesn't produce a heavy, solid rock. You don't get a rock by having dust bounce around. To get a rock, you had to have a gravity well. You had to have a gravity source that pulls all the dust together and then compresses the dust into a solid rock. That's how you make a rock. And so the idea that it came out of the primordial solar nebula is just plain stupid. Secondly, the surface of the asteroids have very clear evidence of having been exposed to a glazing extreme heat. So whatever happened melted the surface of them. So what we have is very clear data that there was a planet there. It did explode. It was a tremendously hot event. It shattered one half of Mars. It covered with rocks and craters and everything like that. That was a bad day on Mars. But it wasn't the end, because like sometime later, I don't know exactly how long, maybe 100,000 years, the nuclear fission explosion happened. So it may have wiped out civilization on Mars, but nature finds a way to bounce back. Somehow people got their stuff together enough to have a nuclear explosion, and that nuclear explosion was the end of you know, the ability of Mars to house a civilization, because that blew up the rest of the atmosphere. Now,
can you tell a little bit? Yeah, tell us a little bit about the people. Focus on the people, that'd be great.
The Cydonia project, Remote Viewing Cydonia Mars, which is available. You can go to the website, farsight.org, and see it now. The Cydonia, that was before the exploding planet. That was not during the time of the fission thing. And so what happened was there was people. Now, Cliff, this is important. They were us. They looked just like us. They acted just like us. They had their...
They're humanoid. Humanoid.
No, they look like you and me. Exactly. You can't tell the difference.
Okay.
Exactly like us. They're not like sort of humanoid with arms and legs. If you were walking around there, you would have thought they were... You would have noticed that you were in some other place, but you would have said, this must be, what is this, Cincinnati or something? I mean, so anyway, the Cydonia region, we have no evidence that it was a face on Mars, but it's like 3 kilometers from corner to corner. It was a city, like an island city surrounded by water, and they had poor shantytown area, they had a middle class area, and they had a really rich area, and they also had incredibly good subway system. We don't have evidence of them flying around in like aircraft, like jets and stuff like that. What the transportation system that seems to have been dominant on Mars was the subway system. Now there's lots of good NASA photos of the subways that have been exposed.
Yeah.
They call them the tubes on Mars. But the remote viewing data, under totally blind condition, went into the Cydonia face on Mars area and also noticed the subway system, went down and explored the whole thing. So it was they were really, really, really fast and modern trains. I mean, really fast. And, you know, it's like our maglev trains, like they were really, and you know, the Martian atmosphere was never very thick. So the idea of sending things around with jet aircraft doesn't make as much sense as subway systems with fast trains. So, you know, you need a thick atmosphere to carry jets and stuff like that. So, you know, basically what happened was when that other planet exploded, there was inundation that occurred. That's when the subway system flooded, the tidal waves occurred. That's what brought it to an end. So if you went back to the Cydonia region right now, You would find no people there, but you would find ruins, and you would find a subway system underneath it. And one of the remote viewers compared it to what would happen in the end of the world type setting if you went to New York and went into the subway system 1,000 years from now. Well, you'd still find it, but it would be a wreck. Well, that's what it looks like. Yeah. That's what it looks like now underneath that. So, but, and we, one of the reasons we know that they were very much like us is when you remote view extraterrestrials, very often they can tell you're remote viewing them. And they turn in the direction of the remote viewer, wherever that remote viewer's focus of ascension is, and stare at you. And as they often start up a conversation. They point at you and things. That we have lots of examples like that. In fact, something big like that is coming in our next project, which is the Phoenix Lights, and that'll be coming out in July.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. This is something you just brought up. You said they were very much like us. Is there a connection between Earth humans and the humanoids of Mars?
That's a good point. Because, you see, we know they were like us because when we were remote viewing them, they had no idea we were remote viewing them. They acted just like humans, and that's what humans are like. Now, when Mars went belly up, those people had to go. Some of them could have gone in ships. We have very clear evidence that they had interplanetary travel, not with chemical rockets, but with like UFO technology that was fast and so on. But they could not have gotten everybody off. So most of everybody simply died. Now, when you die, you have to ask, what are you going to do? So are you going to jump star systems and be born into another civilization on another star system or another galaxy? Well, that's not the most likely thing. Mostly you're going to go to a nearby planet. You'll start over again nearby. And Earth was the place that was next. And so some of them came with ships, relatively few of them. But you can assume that the rest came just by being born here. And eventually there became 7 billion of us here. So, you know, they had to leave. They had to leave. They had to leave Maldek and they had to leave Mars. And so I like to look at the Martians as us when we were there.
What would you say the approximate time would be for them to evacuate Mars and come to Earth?
The best person, you know, that's very hard to get that from remote viewing data. So we have to piece it together with other stuff. The best person to ask for that question is actually John Brandenburg, because he has solid data on when the nuclear explosion happened.
Well, that's scary because his dates are a quarter billion years ago. A quarter billion years ago. That's just mind-blowing.
Actually, I remember him saying stuff that was... I remember clearly in one of his books is that the nuclear explosion happened much more recently. With respect to when the planet exploded, Thomas Van Flandern's data suggested that the planet exploded in the much more recent history. So you're talking more like a span of 10 million years for all of this to have occurred. You know, some of these scientists are still trying to piece together details like that. But the people to read are John Brandenburg and also the books by Thomas Van Flandern in order to look at the evidence yourself to figure out when the dating occurs. For example, when I talked about the Atlantis project and you asked me when it happened, how did I get to 70,000 years? Well, first, we look at what the actual events were, and then we look at the dating that other scientists have for those types of things, like the big explosion that happened. And the big explosion and the genetic evidence clearly points to the Tobe-Kadashvili theory concept that happened in 70,000 years ago. So that's how we got, that was the explosion that happened at that, in that location at that time. And that matched what we were seeing with our remote viewing data. So we put a date on that. It was a unique event that was very clear, having those characteristics, and the mainstream scientists are saying 70,000 years for that event. So we're saying that's good for us. It sounds right. For the dating, you really look towards other people to get the exact dating.
Okay. So let's finish up with a special project that you have a great deal of interest in, and that's the Iapetus moon on one of the Saturn moons. And apparently NASA, one of the NASA space probes, took some imaging of the surface of this moon and detected an artificial dome of some type. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what you've discovered about this and why you're interested in it?
The space probe is called the Cassini space probe, and it was launched. It's still there around orbiting Saturn, taking pictures of all types of stuff. And it was launched to study Saturn and its moons. And one of the pictures that it sent back is a very clear thing on the side of a crater that looks to me like a set of buildings. It has a what looks like a huge set of steps that come out of the buildings. I don't think they were steps. They're too big to be steps, but they have that exact topography. It's exactly what they look like. You'd say that, you know, it's a regular set of steps. And the buildings themselves have smooth sides, and on the top of them they have a circular roof, and they're parallel. They have a few of them that have the exact same shape. And that just doesn't happen when you throw a meteor at a moon and produce a crater. You don't get steps and smooth sides and so on. So I looked at that, and there was some internet chatter about that that I thought was interesting. I saw many years ago, and I said, well, if I ever get the opportunity to send the best remote viewers on the planet to there to find out what the heck that is, I'll do it. So I saved that. And okay. Eventually I had a chance to send Dick Allgaier and Dada Smith under totally blind conditions, recorded live on video, to explore what that is, and they found out. Now, Cliff, the thing that was so amazing, I know we're running out of time, so let me just really get to the chase. That video was just released like a week and a half ago. People can see it right now at our Farsight website, farsight.org. But let me tell you, that was one of the most amazing things. You have to see it to believe it, to understand it, because that was not a military facility. That was not an industrial facility. That was not a spy base or a military or a mining facility. That was a place that was built by one of the richest persons in the solar system before Maldek exploded, before the end of Mars civilization. There was somebody that was richer than Bill Gates, richer than Warren Buffett, richer than Richard Branson. And that guy built a facility on probably the most beautiful spot in the solar system, on an icy barren moon of Saturn, on Iapetus, right underneath the rings of Saturn, and a perfectly unfettered sky with all the stars, with Saturn right next by. You can't imagine a more beautiful location. And he built basically a holiday health spa resort hotel. And people went there, the elite of the elite, to commune, to have a spiritual experience under the rings of Saturn. Obviously, they weren't using chemical rockets to get there. They're using obvious, you know, ships like UFO type stuff where you get there in an hour or two. And they went there and they had, you know, that type of health spa spiritual experience. It was an unusual thing. And then there was a war in the solar system. And I'm assuming it's connected to the same exploding planet, the end of Cydonia, the whole that stuff. And when that war happened, there was no place for those people to go because they weren't growing any food. Everything had to be shipped in. And that's when it died. They were abandoned and they had no place to go. And if we went there today and walked through the facility, some of the power generators and things like that are in standby mode. They're shut down, but they're in standby mode, still generating a little. But we would probably see, I don't think a cleanup crew has been sent, so we would see the bones of the people who died there. They ran out of food, they ran out of water, they ran out of air. We would see them as they died. They had nowhere to go.
Yeah, what's a plus-minus date potential on that?
It's all tied to the same thing. When the planet, it looks like, we don't have an exact date on that, but the war seems to be the signature element in the solar system when that planet exploded. And so when the planet exploded, that's when Cydonia went up. That's when Cydonia ended. And the best person to get that dating from is Thomas Van Flandern, because he has a book. I don't have it right in front of me. And I didn't know I'd be asked that. Otherwise, I would have got the book and pinged out.
No, but I'm just curious.
I believe he's talking a date of like 10 million years, but it's in his books, his most recent book. He's dead now, but he left a large legacy of published work, and his most recent book on that covers that material does have a dating on that. And he has a variety of different ways to determine when the dating occurred. And he goes through that. It's very fascinating stuff.
Okay.
But it wasn't too long ago. It wasn't too long ago.
Well, 10 million years is a lot, but it's, I guess.
Yeah, it's longer than we'll live.
Yeah, in cosmic terms, it's nothing. It's a blink of an eye in cosmic planet building terms. In the few minutes we have left, I have a couple questions for you. Probably the most important for me is when does the government come clean with this material? When, because the more sophisticated our society becomes, the internet, scanning devices, observing devices, telescopes, whatever. I mean, there's thousands of websites that are dedicated to anomalies on Mars, and the refinements, not just using the software like Photoshop, but just the refinements of just observable anomalies, structures, buildings, ruins that have been destroyed, statues. It's all very obvious that these are actual items. When does NASA say, okay, we fess up, this has been here, and because it's ridiculous. Well, I mean, it's clear. Just, yeah.
The government is already totally coming clean with all of this. And let me explain how that's happening. The decision was made to no longer suppress or disrupt the information when it's coming out. People were very old and on their deathbeds are now allowed to speak. They're now allowed to publish what they've done. So all types of information is now coming out by people who are old. People like us at the Barr State Institute are no longer being disrupted. The UFO groups in the early days, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the UFO groups were all systematically disrupted so that they would not gain a large audience. And so all of that has stopped, to my understanding. So what's happening now is the government is letting all those people who are ready, who are capable of understanding it and accepting it, they're letting those people get the information and listen to it, which is why I'm on your show, which is why we have been able to do all of our projects, which is why we're not interrupted. And everybody else is allowed to live in their own fantasy world, meaning the government is not coming to the public and slapping them in the face and saying, wake up, you stupid jerk, don't you see what's been going on? They're letting those people that don't want to see this reality stay in their fantasy world, and they're letting the people who do want to see it, they're letting that information out so that they have access to it. So the key is not the government forcing it, but the government allowing the information out so that those who are ready for it can see it.
Okay. And not blocking it so much, even though
they're still blocking it.
Yeah. They're not really Google Earth a bit, but other than that.
Well, yeah, there are still some, but those are really minor. In the old days, it was a very major cover-up, but what's going on now is extremely minor, and the difference between now and what happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s is just night and day. So in a way, you get a very positive answer. The government is coming clean now, but it's not being active in forcing people who are not ready for it to accept this reality. It's not stopping people from seeing it if they're ready for it.
Okay, very good. Listen, this has been great. My guest today has been Dr. Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute, his website. And by the way, I really encourage everyone to go to Farsight, FARSIGHT.org. And look at some of these videos. He's got a couple that are, I think the one on Atlantis is completely free. Is that correct? I think that one is a complimentary. Yeah. The complimentary 90, video. Yeah.
90% of everything, or 98% of everything on the website is free, including a over 20 hours of instructional material hosted by YouTube on remote viewing procedures. I mean, free text, everything. But and most of our projects are free. But there's some of the recent projects have had to be presented in a formal video type documentary settings hosted by Vimeo or DVD. And those we asked people to buy to see the whole thing because we had no real viable other way to present that type of stuff. These new projects are totally video projects, and so we had to present them in a proper theatrical method.
No, I mean, the your offering is very professional. Everything is very well done, very well edited, and I encourage everyone to go take a look at it. Before I let you go, Courtney, is there anything you want to like to tell our audience, any books that are coming up, any places that you'll be speaking at? Go ahead.
I would like to say one thing that it's really important. We're a nonprofit and we do not advertise. So the only way we have to get information to our people is with things like our free newsletter. So when you come to the website before you leave, click on that subscribe button, put the email address in. We never, ever give out the email addresses for any reason whatsoever to anybody else. And we only have a weekly newsletter that comes out. And if you do go to our YouTube channel, then subscribe to that as well. But the point is that you taking the initiative to subscribe to our newsletter, which is where you'll find out about the YouTube channel as well. That's if you don't subscribe to our YouTube channel, you won't ever hear about us. I mean, if you don't subscribe to our newsletter, you won't ever hear about us because we don't have any advertising to put it in your face. So when you go to the website, click on subscribe to our newsletter. It's free. Goes out once a week. No spam. And then you're connected.
Wow. Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks again. I will be posting some photographs, a link to your Farsight Institute, and some more information on some of the items that I thought were interesting. And much good luck and success to you. And perhaps we'll have you on again, Courtney.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Cliff. It's been a real joy. And you really are a professional interviewer. It was a really, really pro job and a really nice conversation. So thanks.
Yeah, it was fun for me too. Well, that's our show today, everyone. I want to make sure that you do check the Facebook page and make sure that you have a chance to see some of the items that we are discussing today. I'll talk to you again next week. Thanks.